And welcome to Jazz Vignettes from the Hall. I am Fawn Fritzen. In this special series, music enthusiast Steve Gedrose explores the world of jazz from its roots to the present day. He breaks the fascinating, ever-evolving genre of jazz into easily digestible themes, backed up, of course, with plenty of music examples. In each episode, Steve will introduce you to the musicians who were or are some of the key driving forces behind the evolution of jazz music. We recorded Steve's presentations live at the beautiful Old Fire Hall in downtown Whitehorse, Yukon. Annually, between October and April, Jazz Yukon presents the Jazz in the Hall series, 5 concerts featuring local jazz groups. Each event is opened with a presentation by Steve, where he provides some background about the live music performed that evening. Episode 6, titled Jazz Vocalists, introduces several of the most influential singers in the development of jazz. Of the many important figures in the story of vocal jazz, Steve chooses examples from Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Nat King Cole, and Old Blue Eyes, Frank Sinatra. Oh yeah. Here is Steve Gedrose.
Hi, everybody. Because our featured performer tonight is Fawn Fritzen, I thought I should do a talk about jazz singers. So that's what I have lined up. It's really difficult to identify what a jazz singer is, or define, rather. Some people feel that a jazz singer is not a jazz singer unless they scat sing. This is a technique that Louis Armstrong developed, where you're singing like a horn would play, or it's wordless vocals. There's sounds that are singing the melody or improvising on the melody, but it's not the lyrics to the song per se. So that's one definition. The other one is jazz vocalists always bring their own interpretation to a song. Particularly in a live setting, they'll never sing the song the same way twice. So that's the spirit of jazz, really. All instrumentalists play the solo a different way, different tempo, different feeling. So that's kind of what jazz singers are certainly about. The first one, and probably one of the premier singers in the genre I'd like to talk about tonight, is the great Billie Holiday. She lived from 1915 to 1959. And her life was not an easy one. She had a very troubled and tumultuous life, actually, including a very unhappy childhood. The good news for us, the listener, is that all this pain and emotion and trouble that she had comes through in her deeply, deeply expressive style of her singing. And as I spoke about before, defining jazz singers, Billie is kind of unusual in that she did not scat. She had a very limited vocal range, and she performed most songs at kind of a medium or slow tempo. This is atypical in this style. The emotional weight of her vocals will always be remembered and cherished by her many, many fans. Throughout the 30s, 40s, and 50s, Billie played with a number of different bands. In 1937, she recorded with the Count Basie Orchestra, and it was at this point that she developed a relationship with trumpet player Buck Clayton and tenor saxophone player Lester Young. She gave Lester Young the nickname of Prez. That was short for President of the Saxophone, because he was kind of the preeminent soloist in the late 30s. And he gave her the name of Lady Day. Both of these nicknames stuck through the rest of their careers. In 1938, Billie left the Basie group to sing with the Artie Shaw Orchestra. This was, I think, one of the first times where a black singer was singing in front of a white band. For some reason, Artie had the notion to tour in the South. This did not go very well, so after a really hard time on the road, Billie quit the band and went back to New York to sing in a club called Cafe Society. This was one of the first clubs in New York to have an integrated audience, and it was here where she was presented with a racially charged song called Strange Fruit. I don't know if anybody's heard that particular song. It deals with lynching in southern United States of black people, so you can get the image that the strange fruit is these bodies hanging from the tree. And it was a very emotional and very difficult song for her to sing at first, but after the initial performance of this piece, it became one of her biggest numbers and certainly was the highlight of her show during these years. During the 40s, Billie became more and more dependent on drugs, And in the late 40s, in 1947, her mother passed away, which was very traumatic for her. And she was arrested at this point for the possession of heroin. This conviction made it impossible to have a cabaret card, which you needed to perform in clubs in New York. So that was a pretty lean period for her. She was kind of required to tour, and through the late 40s and into the 50s, she continued to tour throughout North America and in Europe. Billie's early influences were the Queen of Blues, Bessie Smith, and Louis Armstrong. Their very significant thing about these two singers was that they really gave the impression that they lived the very lyrics of the songs that they were singing. And certainly Billie brought that to her work as well. She wanted to have the big sound that Bessie had, and she wanted to have the feeling towards the music, melody, and lyrics that Louis Armstrong had. I think she was successful in that. So those were her very earliest influences. She became a major influence herself throughout her career. She always sang kind of behind the beat. You're not sure she's going to get all the words fit in that any given bar. Very like Lester Young played the saxophone. You just thought, oh my gosh, he's not going to get it all in. But of course they do. And it really adds a drama and a weight to the performance. So she really took advantage of that. And it was just this emotional connection that she made with the lyrics that really ensure her place in jazz history. In 1959, she passed away from heart and liver disease caused by her many, many years of substance abuse. And ironically, her influence spread very quickly after her death and gave her more fame than she enjoyed during her lifetime. So it's kind of sad, but that was the way it was. She was an influence, as I mentioned, on many, many singers. There's a ton of singers today. Madeleine Perroux comes to mind, who really have ripped off her style almost totally. But she did influence a lot of different people, particularly Frank Sinatra and Miles Davis claimed a real debt to her, having listened to her, it improved their art. In fact, I was surprised to read that Frank Sinatra was with her in her hotel room and helped get her things that she needed right at the end of her life in 59. So for the first music example, this is track number one, Jim. This is a beautiful song that Billie recorded several times. This one was recorded in 1956, so it's kind of towards the end of her career. You can hear the power in her voice is not there, but it's such an emotional reading, I had to include this one. This is called Good Morning Heartache.
Said goodbye last night. I turned and tossed until it seemed you had gone. But here you are with the dawn. Wish I'd forget you, but you're here to stay. It seems I met you when my love went away. Now every day I stop by saying to you, good morning, heartache, what's new?
He just milks that song for everything it's worth. I read someplace that there's a particular lyric that says, my man is gone. And when the next singer I'm going to talk about, Ella Fitzgerald, sings it, you think, oh, well, he's just gone for cigarettes or something. When Billie sings it, you know, he's gone for good. Like, that's it. So it's just an incredible gift that she had to bring this, the emotion of the lyrics to the song. As I mentioned, the next artist I'd like to discuss is Ella Fitzgerald. Like Billie Holiday, Ella's early life was pretty grim. In fact, she was literally homeless for the year prior to making her big break. In 1934, Ella appeared at the Apollo Theater in Harlem after winning an amateur singing contest, and she got a gig with the house band, which was drummer Chick Webb's band. She fronted the band till 1939, until Chick Webb passed, and then stayed with that band for another 2 years. In 1941, then she began her solo career, went out as a solo act. I'm going to skip ahead now to 1955. Ella appeared in the movie Pete Kelly's Blues. and signed with Norman Granz's fairly new label at this point called Verve, which continues to this day. It's not owned by Granz any longer, but it's a very influential label in jazz. And it was in this period that she started recording a series, at Granz's insistence, of songbook albums. So these are albums featuring the songs of such amazing composers and writers as Cole Porter, George and Ira Gershwin, Richard Rodgers, Lorenz Hart, Harold Arlen, Jerome Kern, and Johnny Mercer. These songs have become known now as the Great American Songbook, and certainly these were very popular records for Ella. She really had such incredible diction that you could hear all the words, which songwriters, of course, loved. So this was a very fertile period for her. During this point, she also played and recorded with the Duke Ellington's Orchestra. He was pretty much top of the heap in those years. In 67, she recorded for both the Capitol and Reprise labels. These albums contained a lot of fairly cheesy pop songs of the day. There wasn't a lot of jazz content there. But in 1972, Norman Granz started a new label. He had since sold Verve, called Pablo. Both Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald recorded a number of albums with this label. With such notable pianists as Oscar Peterson and Count Basie and guitarist Joe Pass. So these were not big bands, these were small jazz groups with the singer up front. And the ones, they're all great, but I particularly love the albums that Ella did with the great Joe Pass on guitar. By 1980, Ella's voice is beginning to show its age, but she retains this swinging, joyful style that she always had. In 1994, she retired from public performance and passed in 96 after a long and severe fight with diabetes. Ella Fitzgerald had perfect pitch. She had a 3-octave range. She was blessed with a very pure tone, and her horn-like improvisational ability is just second to none. She was, as I mentioned, gifted with near-perfect elocution, which is prized by songwriters. I read a quote one time that Ira Gershwin said he didn't know how good he and George's songs were until he heard Ella sing them. I thought that was quite a fitting thing, knowing the huge amount of brilliant songs that the Gershwins wrote. Anyway, when she sang, the listener could always understand all the words. So all the time people were pitching her songs, sing this when I want the words to be heard. I think she was probably arguably the best jazz singer of all time. This musical example I've got tonight is kind of a fun one. She performed a concert in Berlin in 1960, and this is a very famous recording of Mack the Knife. Roll it, Jim, number 2, please. Thanks, Jim. And then she takes a chorus singing like Louis Armstrong. That actually won a Grammy, that performance. I don't think anyone could believe that you could hold it together so musically when the lyrics have gone totally from her mind. It's kind of interesting. On the album, she sets up this song saying, "You're used to a man singing this song, and I hope I remember the lyrics." Well, it turns out she didn't, but I think she covered it just fine. The next example of music I have is by the great Sarah Vaughan. In many ways, Sarah's life and career were very parallel to Ella's. She sang in church as a young girl. Through the 30s, she studied and became a very capable piano player. And then in 1943, she too won a singing contest at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, and she opened for her friend Ella Fitzgerald. During this time, she came to the attention of a pianist and bandleader called Earl Hines, Father Earl Hines, as he was known, and she joined his band. In 1944, she joined the Billy Eckstein Band. This band was important because it was the first big band to really bring in bebop phrasing and bebop tunes into their repertoire. And she worked with bebop pioneers at this time in this band, Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. She also began to bring in bebop phrasing into her singing, which was really the first, she was the first vocalist to incorporate this, which was really significant and stuck with her throughout her career. During the 50s, she recorded both pop material and some memorable jazz dates for the Mercury label. In 1977 to 82, she recorded also, as Ella had, with Norman Grant's Pablo label, using some very small jazz groups that really featured her swinging voice. In 1990, Sarah, who had been a smoker for most of her life, died of lung cancer at the age of 66. Her amazing breath control, her wide vocal range, and her incredible ability to scat was really her strong point. There was really nothing she couldn't do with her voice. There's been a lot of speculation that she could have sung opera had she had the desire to, and I certainly believe that. Through her life, she had several well-earned nicknames. I love the one called Sailor, which was because of her salty language. She also was called Sassy because she was very outgoing and she liked to party. And later on, the title that stuck with her really was The Divine One. And I think you'll know what they mean when I play this example number 3, please, Jim. This is a beautiful record that she made in 1954 featuring trumpet great Clifford Brown. This is Lullaby of Broadway, Miss Sarah Vaughan.
When you sigh, never in my word land could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Have you ever heard two turtle doves, bill and coo, when they love? That's the kind of magic music we make with our lips when we kiss. And there's a weepy old willow, he really knows how to cry.
Sarah Vaughan, boy, she could do it, couldn't she? I'd like to talk about a couple of guys now. We've had the gals' turn. So the first one I'd like to mention is the great Nat King Cole. Cole was taught piano by his mother in his early years and later took a few lessons, but became an amazing pianist and began to lead his own bands as a teenager. In 1934, and this is very common in the jazz world too, he drops out of high school to pursue his music career. In 1937, now lived in Los Angeles and puts together a group with Oscar Moore on guitar and Wesley Prince on bass. This became the King Cole Trio. During this period, he is becoming more known as a vocalist than a piano player. In 1943, his recording of That Ain't Right becomes number one on the Billboard charts. This is a significant thing for any black performer. And Johnny Miller replaces Wesley Prince on the bass. The group signs with Capitol Records. In 1944, they had 4 songs on the black record charts. And at this point, Cole starts making his first international tours, starting a trend of playing the top nightclubs and concert halls all around the world. By this time, mid-40s, he's singing way more and playing piano less. In 1951, he broke up the King Cole Trio and began to go out on his own as a solo act. It's kind of ironic because often he would be backed by guitar, bass, and drums, not unlike his former group. In 1956, he becomes the first African-American to host a network TV show series. This was the Nat King Cole Show. In 57 to 59, he focuses on his acting career. In 1962, he returns to the top 10 hit parade with his hit of Ramblin' Rose. I sure remember that well. And in 63, those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summers became his last top 10 hit. In 65, Nat King Cole was diagnosed and passed away from lung cancer. He was only 45 years old. And I've read that he felt that smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, which he did for quite a few years, gave the rich tone and husky nature of the tone to his voice. It also took away his voice eventually, but that was less known in those years, of course. As I mentioned, he began his career as a jazz pianist. He was influenced by Father Earl Hines, who was Sarah Vaughan's early employer. And he had a huge influence on a young piano player coming up from Canada called Oscar Peterson. And if anybody has the Mercury vocal jazz set, you can hear Oscar singing uncannily like Nat Cole. It's really quite amazing. I fooled a lot of people in a blindfold test on that one over the years. Unlike many of his other black contemporaries, he was well known for his efforts to integrate his race into white America. He sued hotels that wouldn't let him stay there. He moved into Hancock Park in Los Angeles, which is a very exclusive white-only neighborhood at that point. His husky voice and careful enunciation, added to the warmth of his delivery and his good-humored approach, saw him score over 100 singles on the pop charts, and more than 24 of his albums charted over his 20-year career. This acclaim ranks him only behind Frank Sinatra as the most successful singer of his time. This song I'd like to play, called Straighten Up and Fly Right, it's a tune that Nat wrote. The story is taken from a folk tale that his father used in a sermon as a minister. So this is from 1944. This is with the King Cole Trio, Straighten Up and Fly Right.
Took a monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on the square. The buzzer tried to throw the monkey off of his back. The monkey grabbed his neck and said, "Now listen, Jack. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Ain't no use in."
I have one more person I'd like to talk about, and that's a guy I really think of the world of. That's Frank Sinatra. He also dropped out of high school to pursue a career in music. He played with the Harry James Orchestra in 1939 and made his initial recordings. Throughout the 40s, he was with several big bands, including Tommy Dorsey's orchestra. In 45, he has 8 recordings in the top 10. He was really the first teen pop idol, Frank Sinatra was. Through the 40s, he worked in many films. And in 1953, he won an Academy Award for his role in From Here to Eternity. In 1954, it was a very significant year for Frank. He started working with the great composer and arranger Nelson Riddle. They did a number of albums together. It was a very great relationship they had. Nelson really understood Frank and really was able to draw out the emotional subtext of the lyrics Frank was singing in his arrangements. 1955, they did an album called In the Wee Small Hours, which is a collection of ballads. I love that record. It's just beautiful. Later, it was inducted to the Grammy Hall of Fame, so other people felt that was a significant one as well. In 61, he launched Reprise Records, which continues today. That was his creation. In 1964, even though the Beatles and there was a British invasion in the U.S. at this point, Frank still continued to make top 10 lists with his albums. In 66, he wins a Grammy for Strangers in the Night. In 69, he releases My Way with special lyrics by Paul Anka. This really became his signature song at that point. In 71, Frank is now 55 years old and announces his first retirement. He had several through his career. This one only stuck for 2 years, but it was a big deal at the time that he was not going to be around anymore. In 1990, Frank turned 75, and there were endless CD reissues and tributes to him and his career. In 93, he recorded, which turned out to be one of his most successful albums ever. It was the Duets album, where he sang with the contemporary singers Julio Iglesias, Bono, Aretha Franklin, Barbra Streisand, and the like. 1995, at age 80, Frank retires for real, and in 98, passed away from a heart attack. The length and breadth of Sinatra's 50-year career is really astonishing. He was not only successful as a singer, but as a very talented actor as well. I don't think any other performer will equal his beautiful baritone voice and his unique phrasing. To me, his version is the definitive version of that particular song. I'd like to play this track now from an album he did in 55 and 56. This is arranged and conducted by his buddy Nelson Riddle, and it's You Make Me Feel So Young.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel so spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I wanna go play hide and seek. I wanna go and bounce the moon just like a toy balloon. You and I are just like a couple of tots.
I meant to point out prior to that, there's all kinds of things going on in the arrangement, but the crucial thing is Frank's voice, front and center, never buried by endless orchestras and all kinds of instruments behind him. Just the wonderful relationship he had with Nelson Riddle. There really only ever be one chairman of the board, and that's Frank Sinatra. Thanks, folks. That's my thumbnail sketch of jazz vocalists.
You have been listening to the sixth installment of Jazz Vignettes from the Hall, titled Jazz Vocalists. We recorded this episode in November 2011. This program was made possible by Jazz Yukon. Jazz Yukon is a volunteer organization that promotes and presents jazz in the Yukon through an annual integrated program of live jazz presentations and jazz education outreach. This episode was researched, written, and presented live by Steve Gedrose. Live recording by Jim Holland. Dieter Gade is our producer, and I am Fawn Fritzen. Thank you for listening.
Blazing their light, can't hold a candle to your razzle-dazzle. You got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride full of butterflies inside. Wanna laugh like a loon. It's that old devil moon in your eyes. Just when I think I'm free as a dove, old devil moon deep in your eyes blinds me with love. Flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride full of butterflies inside. moon. Wanna laugh like a loon. It's that old devil moon.